One of the committee members who's new on the committee actually this year, when we were talking about the framework, you know, our hopes for the conference, he kind of said, oh yeah, when you guys announced it last year, I was kind of a bit like, oh yeah, I mean, it's important, but it's a bit boring.
Not seen.
Yeah, that's right. But then as we were talking about it, he kind of was going, oh, this is going to be amazing. So I think that's part of the reason we wanted to do the podcast, is just to kind of go, hey, actually, there's a wealth of wonderful stuff to think through here and really important stuff as well. Welcome back to the Effective Ministry Podcast, the podcast that helps you have an effective youth and children's ministry in your church. I'm Al James, a youth ministry advisor with YouthWorks in Sydney. And today I'm also wearing another hat as director of House Conference, which is a conference run by YouthWorks in August that is all about helping youth and children's workers move from theology to practice. It's a great conference, and I reckon it's pretty rare. Lots of conferences on theology, lots on the practice of ministry, less that move intentionally from theology to practice. And so today I have a conversation about the theme of August's conference, Sin, the Uncomfortable Truth. Mike Dicker, who's the principal of YouthWorks College and House Committee member, and I have a conversation about why we chose the topic for this year's conference. And we follow that up with a great conversation with Toby McGregor, Mel Bell, and Kathy Dell about why the doctrine of sin, how we think about it, the language we use for it, and how we teach it matters so much as we disciple young people to know and love and follow Jesus. All three minister to young people, Mel at Roseville, Kathy at Layla Park, Toby at Normanhurst, and Toby is also a member of the House Conference Committee. I think the conversation will show you what a rich and important topic the doctrine of sin is, and how important it is to have a nuanced and robust view of it. And so if you want to come to House Conference on the 27th to the 29th of August, just go to youthworks.net/house. Early bird registration is open until the end of May, so get in before then to get a discount on the full rate. It's a great discussion with Mike, Mel, Kathy, and Toby. So let's get into it. Today we want to talk about the doctrine of sin and how a biblical view of that doctrine impacts on how we approach ministry to young people, how we think about ourselves as youth and children's ministry leaders, and how it influences our practice. And we want to have this conversation because it's such an important part of our theological framework. As we think about everything, the doctrine of sin touches on so many things, including youth and children's ministry. But it's also because of the importance of the subject, we're going to have a whole conference on the doctrine of sin. It's coming up. It's called House Conference, which is a conference all about moving from theology to practice in youth and children's ministry. And so I want to start with a conversation with Mike. Mike, we serve on the House Committee together. Why did we choose this topic for House Conference this year?
Yeah, I think this is just one of those topics I've noticed over the years at House Conference that keeps coming up again and again. And I think actually it was the wisdom literature, wisdom for discipleship, and looking at the wisdom literature at that House Conference, that I remember thinking we need to think a little bit more deliberately about our language for sin and how we talk about it and how it kind of fits in with a whole bunch of other categories in theology. And particularly at that conference, there was a question asked about foolishness and sinfulness. And when does someone's foolishness, say, become sin, or when is being a fool sinful, or when is sin just foolishness and maybe not sinful? And it kind of opened up this can of worms. I noticed on different tables I was sitting on at that conference that people had an idea of sin that I would say would be a basic or maybe a thin description of sin. We know it's really important. We know that we need to talk about it in order to talk about the gospel of grace. But we didn't have a very nuanced or deep understanding about the different ways we should kind of talk about sin and how it related with the human experience. And so I think a whole conference to kind of talk about the doctrine of sin, the way that it influences us, the different ways the Bible talks about it, will just do us the world of good.
Yeah. And last year we were looking at the theology of emotions, and we, you know, similar things like how does sin, you know, interact with the idea of emotions, you know, desire and sin, all kinds of ways in which this particular kind of interacts. And, you know, we were looking at identity and freedom a couple of years ago as well. Just that kind of question of, well, what's the relationship between who I am and sin and the doctrine of sin? So totally, it's come up that many times that it's a really, really useful conversation to have.
Yeah. And I think we've got a pretty good understanding of original sin. So, or at least what the classics or the theologians will call original sin, which is the way that human beings are broken. Well, again, I'm already
using language already.
Right. Because I could say damaged, broken, fallen,
disordered,
faulty, disordered. Yeah. All those kinds of things. Again, every time you use a word like that to explain sin, you're importing something into what you think it means. So it would be nice for us to kind of think about the language that the Bible uses for sin. But I think we have a good idea of original sin, that in everything we do, it is tainted by fallibility, right? That even our best intentions for things and even the greatest good works we do may have some sort of corruption involved in them. And so we have that kind of understanding, right? And probably the hard edge of original sin will be, how does it play out in, say, infants and, those, I guess, younger people that we would see as kind of pure and innocent. But then generally, the world kind of, I think, appreciates the idea that, everyone has their own foibles. Everyone has their own idiosyncrasies. We don't even like people that are too perfect. If you see someone who has everything, they're good at sport and music, and they're good looking, and they can sing, and they're personable, and they're smart at maths, I'm just like, please, someone trip them over, right?
I hate that guy.
I need to see a weakness. And there's one there for sure. There's definitely one there. But then I think when it comes to talking about how sin plays out in the world, I don't think we're particularly thoughtful. Mm. And so we start talking about sin in moralistic terms, like sin is just the bad things you do, the bad thoughts that you have. And then I think it starts to get heaps more complex. Because if sin is just the bad things you do, what about the non-Christian person who actually behaves better and is a better civilian and a better person than some of the people you find in your churches, right? Like then now all of a sudden we think, oh, that doesn't seem to match up quite well. And then if we think of, sin as our bad thoughts, well, okay, but which of my thoughts are kind of sinful because they're deliberate? And then which of my thoughts are just, they're unwanted thoughts and desires or unwanted kind of things that just intrude our brain and then go back out again? And how do we talk about that? And I think we probably do ourselves a little bit of a disservice when we kind of think of sin as just a sledgehammer term to cover anything that we just think is wrong. And of course, as you look through church history, people have described all kinds of cultural phenomena as sinful just because it doesn't fit with their same cultural expectations. I'm reading again One Blood by John Harris about, 200 years of Christianity's interaction with Indigenous people. Some beautiful stories in there about Christian people dignifying Indigenous people of Australia, seeing them as human and therefore, worthy to receive the gospel, as opposed to, your Darwinian evolutionary colonialists that just want to wipe them out as fauna. So that real dignifying thing. But then you see in their journal entries that an Indigenous person has understood the gospel, they've believed it, they're convinced about what they've believed. But because they won't wear a shirt and tie and long pants and settle down for agricultural farming, then they're still sinful. Mm. And you think, you read it right now, 200 years later, and you're thinking, how is it a sin? How is it a sin not to be an agricultural farm?
Yeah, canonizing a cultural form and calling it sin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm totally aware that we're doing that right now, right? Like not necessarily in this podcast, but we're doing it at the moment where we're saying, I grew up in a Church of Christ church, like Baptist, right? Drinking and smoking is definitely a sin. Gambling's a sin. Dancing, a sin, no sex that leads to dancing, all that kind of stuff. So, you then start to think, is that right? Like, or have I just imported my own cultural expectations and now made them sin? So again, there's sort of like a whole plethora of reasons why we need to kind of talk about how we use the language of sin.
Mike, when we were talking about what topic we'd do and thinking about, raising this topic of sin, you drew my attention to this quote from Alain de Botton. So he's an atheist philosopher, but he kind of likes religion, doesn't he? So he kind of said this. He said, "Enlightenment thinkers believed that they were doing us a favor by declaring man to be originally and naturally good. However, being repeatedly informed of our native decency can cause us to become paralyzed with remorse over our failure to measure up to impossible standards of integrity. Confessions of universal sinfulness turn out to be a better starting point from which to take our first modest steps towards virtue. An emphasis on original sin, he says, further serves to answer any doubt as to who can have the right to dispense moral advice in a democratic age, to the incensed query, "And who are you to tell me how to live?" A believer need only push back with a disarming response, "A fellow sinner." I mean, this guy seems to think that the doctrine of original sin is kind of freeing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, I was just reflecting on the title of our conference, the uncomfortable truth. And surely that certainly strikes a chord with us, because it can be really uncomfortable to talk about sin. But an alternative title for the conference could be the liberating truth. And I think that's what Alain de Botton is getting to. But I mean, he's put his finger on something here. Which is, yeah, you keep telling people that they're good all the time. You keep telling people that the world is their oyster and that they should follow their dreams and aspirations and actualize themselves in the world. That's fine if you succeed. But if you don't succeed, then you're a loser, right? You've been handed everything on a plate. You just had to work hard and you could have earned your way to be the next, you know, Elon Musk or something. But instead, you're just a whatever, like a measly kind of, you know, unemployed, you know, person who has to, you know, rent for the rest of their life and live off kind of the help of others or whatever it's going to be. And now all of a sudden that's your fault. And the Christian gospel is liberating. It says, no, actually we have people that have been blessed with certain things, you know, and all of us, everything good that we have is a gift, not something which we have by right because of our decency. So I think, yeah, I mean, he's definitely got some really good insights that will help us think about our own culture.
Mm-hmm. And something you said as you were talking about that there kind of reminded me why we did call it the sin, the uncomfortable truth. You know, that idea that in actual fact, you know, perfection can be a real burden. And that's partly because there's a real push against the idea that any sort of external expectation might be put on people. And so actually, the doctrine of sin does place an external expect, you know, places the expectation of God in some senses on people. And so that's one of the reasons that it's very difficult to talk about. And the reason we did call it sin, the uncomfortable truth, because the freight that the idea of sin carries with it and the culture that we've got now where no one can tell me what to do because the truth of who I am emerges from deep within me. So any kind of external sense of expectation is really unpalatable. And so that's the kind of, I guess that's what we're thinking as we were kind of naming the conference. But it is so good to be thinking about the idea that it's not just uncomfortable, hard to talk about, but actually it's also liberating as well.
Yeah, well, I think this is why the idea of original sin, I think Alain de Botton is happy with, because it tells us that we should all just be a little bit more gentle with ourselves because we're all fallible human beings. I think he would be less comfortable with you telling him that some of his behaviors were sinful, or perhaps his relationship with the God he doesn't believe in is a sin, even though he's a good citizen. And I think actually that's when it becomes uncomfortable. And I also think as well, we sometimes make talking about sin more uncomfortable than it needs to be because we don't have a proper theology of how sin plays itself out in practice. So I'll give you a great example, actually. I haven't heard anyone use this in a sermon for a while, but like my, you know, radar alarm bells go off every time when you hear someone talk about sin and they say,
I'm just getting ready to kind of critique my own sermon at some point.
So. Yeah, that's right. For all of you who did this on Sunday, your sin is the same as Hitler's. And I'm like, no, like that's not true. Like it's patently not true. Like, you know, Hitler massacred a whole millions of people and like genocide, right? That is not the same as you having a thought, even a sinful thought of hatefulness against your brother, as Jesus would say in Matthew. And so here's the thing, actually, you need to really talk about is hierarchies of sin, right? Now, that's something that comes out in the scriptures. You know, Paul will talk about it in 1 Corinthians, where he says, all other sins a man commits outside his body, but sins of a sexual nature he commits against himself, that's a different type of sin. And you think about more explicitly Rahab, who also lied to protect her neighbor, to love her neighbor, though she was in a position to help. She lied. And in the Bible, it explicitly says what she did was righteous. You know, so it's not as if she, well, she was a pagan then. She didn't really know that lying was bad. But now when she became an Israelite, then she knew it was bad. It's like, no, what she did was righteous. Now, how can we say that giving false testimony in one scenario is a sin, but in this other scenario, it's righteous? Now, all of a sudden, sin becomes a lot more complicated.
Well, it harks back to the idea of wisdom, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's right. Again, now, wisdom, sure, but there's got to be right and wrong in this world, Al. And if you take right and wrong out of it, like, where's the objective truth? Then, you know, this world's going to hell in a handbasket. Next thing you know, we can all just justify whatever we want to do. That's not true, right? In fact, you know, loving your neighbor as yourself, loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor, the whole law hangs off those two. They are the two most important. And all other kind of laws are subordinate to them. And then there's a wisdom in also knowing how to interact or turn up in the world as you obey those top two commands. Jesus, there's lots to say about this. And again, if we don't have a conversation about that, we'll just end up calling everything sin. And I think we make it more uncomfortable for ourselves to talk about when we misuse sinful labels, or maybe just misapply them without the kind of theological robust thought to go along with it.
I think we can already see there's a whole bunch of stuff to talk about when we're thinking about the doctrine of sin. One of the committee members who's new on the committee actually this year, when we were talking about the framework, you know, our hopes for the conference, he kind of said, oh yeah, when you guys announced it last year, I was kind of a bit like, oh yeah, I mean, it's important, but it's a bit boring.
Not sin.
Yeah, that's right. But then as we were talking about it, he kind of was going, oh, this is going to be amazing. So I think that's part of the reason we wanted to do the podcast, is just to kind of go, hey, actually, there's a wealth of wonderful stuff to think through here, and really important stuff as well. So some of the things we want to be doing at the House Conference will be to explore the language for explaining sin. Mike's touched on that a little bit. So every time we use the word brokenness, or we talk about folly, or we talk about rebellion, or whatever it is, these things carry a whole bunch of freight. And so we want to be thinking intentionally about how we use language and what that might communicate at a holistic level. When we think about the doctrine of sin and how, you know, what our kids and our youth are taking on from that. We want to explore the different ways in which we portray sin as we teach children and youth as well. What are the different kind of analogies we use? And again, what does that kind of convey about sin? Does it capture one bit really well, but other parts not so well, and so on? And then we want to think about what are the implications of the doctrine of sin for how we go about ministry. Think about, are there blind spots or barriers in young people understanding sin? Because, you know, the world they're living in is not one that particularly finds it easy to talk about sin. Are there blind spots in our ministry practices and that kind of thing? So we want to put it all on the table and hopefully work from kind of theological principles and, you know, really exploring this into really rich and freeing and, you know, that idea of liberating but truthful exploration of sin, and, you know, discipling our kids into with a fuller understanding of the doctrine of sin to help them in their faith. So House Conference, plugging it now, come along, going to be in August, end of August. It's going to be fantastic. 3 days that will be spent really, really well. What I want to do now, though, is just pivot, I guess, from thinking about why we're raising the topic to be thinking about the significance of the doctrine of sin in our churches, in our kids' ministries, and in our youth ministries. And so Kathy, Mel, and Toby, they're here from Churchland, and they're going to, you know, spend some time thinking a little bit about why it's so significant that we talk about. So question is, guys, what is the significance of the doctrine of sin for you guys in your ministries? And then why does our understanding of it and how we talk about it and teach it in our ministries matter? We're going to start with Kathy.
I think that the reason sin's so important is because the stakes are so high. So I think about my, not just in ministry, like practicing stuff, but also just in like my family and my friends, that they're kind of any church trauma or resistance to coming back to church or not walking in the building is almost always from kind of a mishandling of the doctrine of sin or a misunderstanding. And I think, yeah, the gospel is offensive, like by its very nature. And so we need to really handle the parts that are offensive super well, because it already is, and it already hurt in a good way, in a way that drives us to Jesus. But yeah, I think I look at my friends and I go, actually, you were told things that kind of distracted you from the core message because we didn't handle sin super well. So I think that, and like grace and sin are so tied together. And so I think that's the key part, right? Like grace is not as good without sin. And sin is paralyzing without grace. And so if we don't know why we need grace and we don't know how big the offer is on hand because we haven't handled sin and the doctrine of sin well, then we've got so much to work on and so much to improve so that, yeah, the message is good news and not paralyzing or scary news. I think about it like, I grew up on the North Shore. And so for some people, like money wasn't an issue. And then for other people, it really was. And so when people would get scholarships or like opportunities and things, the difference in the thankfulness and the gratitude and the like how much it meant to people was fully dependent on, well, were you going to get that opportunity anyway, but someone was going to pay for it and it might not have been you. You're not as thankful as you are if it's like, actually, that wasn't on the table until I got this scholarship or this opportunity. And so I think it's similar with sin. If we don't realize how big sin is, then grace is not as...
It just seems a bit trite.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, thank you so much for that grace. Oh, yeah. Great.
Yeah, I'm so thankful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas
when
you realize how big it is, it's overwhelmingly a gift.
I think also we shortchange the rescue plan of the whole Bible if there isn't anything to be rescued from. And very few civilizations over the, you know, course of human history have assumed that we're right with God naturally and that we don't have a need to be helped and saved. And however that's played out culturally might look different. But, 1 John 1 talks about if we claim to be without sin, we're just deceiving ourselves. And I think that's the culture that we're living in now is we're not just battling how do we be saved from sin? How do we get right with God? It's the premise that's in question. Do we need to be saved?
Mm.
And actually, we're just deceiving ourselves because all we need to look at is our own heart, minds, and, you know, minutes in a day to see how broken we really are.
Yeah.
So I think we shortchange the significant rescue plan that God has been working throughout history when we say, oh, sin's not that big a deal, or it's too hard to talk about with kids and youth and it's too loaded. Let's focus on grace.
You make God smaller when you make sin smaller in some ways, don't you? You were saying something there that made me think about the Billy Graham Crusades, where, you know, like in many ways, what the Billy Graham Crusades was about saying to people that understood Christianity, that understood their sinfulness, hey guys, come now, come and be saved from the thing you understand. And so it rang true for them. But, you know, society is different now that actually the premise of actually you might need salvation from sin, it's just not there. We don't agree on that. That platform is not there to kind of put the gospel on in the same way. So we have to do some kind of groundwork, don't we? And when we do the groundwork, it shows the glory of the gospel all the more, which is wonderful. What a good topic.
Absolutely. And it's good news. Like our kids need to know that the brokenness of the world and their own fallibility as humans, that there's an antidote and an answer and there's hope and it's freeing and it's not based on their own efforts. I mean, I'm ministering on the North Shore where Kathy grew up. And if anything, the pressure and the crushing expectations of the world is, you know, producing this perfectionism and this high achieving culture that says, if you're not X, Y, and Z, you know, what are you doing with your life? And yet the gospel says you're never going to be perfect in your own strength. God knew that all along and provided a plan, and we get to live in the freedom of that. So it's shortchanging who God is and the sacrifice of his son, but also shortchanging our lives and diminishing the freedom and the joy and the peace that we can have when we're in Christ.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the challenges in that is that sin is, to have a healthy doctrine of sin is something that is freeing because it gives us permission to not be perfect and alleviates that pressure. But at the same time, we need to be careful not to be condoning sin. So I think there's that admission of it that frees us without taking away the responsibility of repentance as well. And so I think, like, going back on kind of to what Kathy was saying earlier, of if we don't have a healthy dose and doctrine of sin, we actually end up making grace cheap, right? When we rush to grace, we forget. And so I think like the confession forms are really helpful because they cause us to pause, recognize sin, recognize the weight of that sin, and then brings us to the beautiful declaration of forgiveness and grace. And I think that flow is really significant in that.
Do you think we're more likely to tend towards moralism with children and young people, or tend towards being permissive of their behaviors? I don't know.
Yes, and saying.
Both at the same time.
You think both permissive and also moralizing? Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I wonder, young people typically, from their earliest age, kind of know discipline, yeah. Or, don't touch, don't eat, don't, do this, go to sleep, why are you out of bed, get back to bed, why'd you do that? They get the kind of parenting seems to be full of, right? All those simple kind of, commands and teaching what's bad and what's good. So I guess that moralizing. But I don't know whether or not you see more permissive sort of parenting, more permissiveness these days in youth and kids ministry.
Yeah, I think there is, but I also think it's not like that. It's just less authoritarian. So I think we still have parents. I mean, there is an argument. I think that kids are becoming CEOs in their households a little bit more than, I think there is a place that is happening in some households. I do think that. But I also think that there's just the less, aggression's probably not the right word, but the assertiveness in that there's a way of helping and getting kids alongside parents as they make decisions. And so it might be that they're actually just less aware of wrongness in general, because it's not just no, you can't, but it's like, this is why that's unhelpful. And I do think that's a good way to go with kids, because I think it gives us a really helpful view of how God relates to us as sinful people and as his children. I think that that kind of wave in parenting, of that gentle parenting, of the consequences matching what kids have done wrong, is really helpful. And I think we're kind of bringing more self-confident kids that are less terrified of everything and terrified of a God who, thinks they've disappointed, that, that they can disappoint God all the time. But I do think that there's something that we just need to be wary of there, that, that we need to kind of show, actually, here are all the ways that daily we let God down, and that isn't exclusive to them, but that it's actually everyone, and that's humanity. And Yeah, I think that's been challenging for me, is trying to get, because you kind of have, I think I've always seen there's what's largely two really kind of strong reactions. And it's the people don't realize they need grace, and people who are all too aware. And I know that I was the all too aware, significant amount of my mental health stuff came from just not really understanding, not understanding grace and not being able to really understand that I was fully forgiven, and just feeling paralyzed and overwhelmed and burdened and guilty. But that was because I was super aware of my sin, but I didn't quite understand that I wasn't the only one in that situation, that actually that there is my personal sin, but also that by nature we have turned against God. It's not just me personally who has, destroyed my relationship with God, that actually each and every one of us has done that. Regardless of if we wish we hadn't.
Yeah. And I think it's key. I talk with our parents and our leaders a lot about modeling what it looks like to see our own sin as well. That it's not just kids and young people who are sinful. Mm. It's the ministers who are preaching at the front of church, and it's the kids ministry leaders, and it's parents, and it's our kids and young people. And the journey of discipleship isn't saying, I'm so much less sinful than you, you got to catch up to me. The journey is walking side by side and saying, I've fallen short today. Mm. Here's how. And in ways I don't even know about yet, he's forgiven me.
As you talk there, Mel, the doctrine of sin to me seems to be fundamentally kind of the most humble thing you can do, is to believe the doctrine of sin, the doctrine of the universal sinfulness of all humanity, including me. Christianity, when it's, we all live it so badly in some ways, but Christianity in all its glory is actually about the humility, having a posture of humility towards God, agreeing with God about who we are and what we've done. So I love that idea that actually the doctrine of sin can kind of impart to us that freeing humility. Toby, love to hear your thoughts too.
I was just thinking a little bit more on that, in that one of the things that I'm particularly working on in my own practice now, having now sat on the committee to come up with this idea was, what does it look like for me to practice my own humility in my leadership of the youth ministry? And so I'm consciously a lot more time and effort and energy pulling young people aside and apologizing to them when I realize I've done something that hasn't been helpful for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I think that's been really beneficial for them, but it's been really beneficial for me to sit down. And I guess there's, it's made me grow more confident in my own limitations, which has helped make me, I think it's made our youth ministry healthier, but also it's made me appreciate the sufficiency of God in our ministry as well, because it's not riding on me. I don't need to be, when I'm up the front preaching or when I'm walking alongside a high schooler, I don't need to have all the answers. And actually, I'll stuff it up. And to acknowledge that, I think helps the young people learn what confessing their sins look like. And so as I practice apologizing, I think it's empowered our young people to also feel that freedom of, it's okay to not have it all together. It's okay to be sinful, as long as we take it to repentance and actually confess to one another, Book of James, but also bring before the Lord and trust in God's, trusting Christ's a completely sufficient atoning sacrifice. And so I think, yeah, just
maybe we should have called the conference Sin Boldly, Toby.
Anyway, you've already done the graphic design.
But yeah. I still really like the title, because I think we don't like talking about sin. We don't actually like talking about our own sin, and admitting our own sin, let alone. And so I think I guess in some ways we're similar to the quote earlier, right? We're happy to talk about original sin because it's still kind of out there. But as soon as it starts talking about my sin, I start feeling a little bit cagey.
Yeah.
I imagine as well that there are people that were listening to or seeing the graphic for this house conference and thinking, I don't want to go to a conference that's going to talk about sin. Right. Like, for exactly the same reasons, like it's uncomfortable to talk about. Maybe we're going to come down too heavy handed about it. It's going to be just, you know, unthoughtful, hard edged, or maybe it's going to be too soft on sin. I mean, they're the classic kind of, you know, anxieties people have about this topic. So yeah, maybe uncomfortable truth is exactly the right time.
I was just teaching, we've just finished a series at church with all our ages on Romans 1-6. And so this is freshly in my mind. We did it with our preschoolers and primary kids and high schoolers. And it's fascinating. I think kids give us a really good picture of the condition of sin and the nature of sin, because, you know, they're just less inhibited maybe. And they just, you know, you don't have to teach a kid to snatch stuff and hit other kids. It falls out in their behavior as they grow up, whether it's family or friends or whatever. But it was fascinating, even in the preschool room, teaching. We're doing Romans 3, we've all fallen short of the glory of God. And part of the teaching we were doing was, let's look through God's word and see if we can spot anyone who has no sin. And, you know, even preschoolers, they can see from the get-go, King David, he had sin. And, Daniel, he had sin. And Abraham, and you know, they're happy to list Paul. And the only one without sin is Jesus. But the best part was hearing their answer to, what about me? And they were quick to say, yeah, Mel, you have sin. Yes. Okay, what about you? Oh, no, I don't have sin. No. And so this huge case being built for this like beautiful naivety, but just like, oh, everybody else.
Yeah, wow.
Sinful. I see it. Me? No. And it was wonderful to be able to say, I'm sinful, you're sinful, the only one who's not is Jesus, and that's why we need him. So we don't leave them in the worry. The cure for sin's already been completely paid for. It's good news. But isn't that such a good picture of just what we do as humans? Oh, me? Everybody else is the problem, not me.
Yeah,
I feel like every time I do confession prayer with any age group, but particularly with my like primary school kids, there's just this like, oh, I can't really think of anything. And I'm like, oh, what about like 3 minutes ago where you hit your sister? And they're like, oh yeah, that's good. And like, we have at our church, like, no sibling rivalries at church, because I'm just so sick of mediating debate between kids about something that happened a week ago at home. And like, I'm happy to do it, but I just am like, I think if I just point to your sibling relationships, you will be aware. And I say that because that is where I was most aware of my sin as a teenager. I was like, oh, my sister who's 18 months younger than me isn't less of a person, and therefore the way I treat her is like not okay. And I think, yeah, like what you were saying, Toby, earlier about how it's important for us to do it. Like, I think so much of the critique of Christians is the hypocrisy, but by nature, the gospel makes us hypocrites because we're saying, yes, we shouldn't be doing this and we want to be doing this like Jesus, but we know we're going to fall short. And so it's not about not being a hypocrite. It's about acknowledging that we know we're going to fall short and that we have fallen short. And if we have that really healthy and consistent habit of confession and talking about those sins, then it becomes less painful to realize, oh, actually my leaders aren't perfect because they never said they were. I remember when I was leading youth before I even thought about ministry that I thought, doesn't, at the end of the day, the worst thing I can do is have led them for 3 years and they finish thinking that it's not going to be hard to follow Jesus and that they're not going to stop up. Because if they finish it thinking that the goal is perfection, then they're in for a lifetime of disappointment. Like, that's
one of the things I love about the communal confession of sin, like in liturgy, is it, to give us all the things that we've done and all the things that we've failed to do. And that's often a thing as well. Right? We ask someone, do you have sins that you need to confess? No, I can't think of anything. And actually, in that space of the thing that you can't think about, there could be a whole range of things that you just haven't even noticed, right? Which is why we kind of pray that general confession of sin. And the perfectionist thing, I think, is really kind of interesting. One of my favorite hobbies at the moment is trying to spot Christian doctrines in secular society that have been, basically grasped from Christianity and then bastardized. And one of the ones is, I think, sinless perfectionism, right? As in, I've noticed it kind of everywhere, but it appears mostly kind of in, I guess, left-wing sort of politics, but it certainly happens just in politics in general, is we have an expectation in society that people in leadership should be sinless and perfect. Mm. And so therefore, politicians and people in the public eye need to go into their background in a race, any offensive tweets that they may have done.
Yeah.
You need to pretend that you have all the answers. You need to make sure you've got your whole life together. Your photo has to be of a happy family, happy wife, happy kids, happy everything. We want leaders who are perfect, right? So we have this sinless perfectionist expectation of our public figures. Even rugby league players, right? And so when they let us down, all of a sudden we're like, oh, well, cancel them. You're out, right? Turns out actually there's a chink in your armor. And with the idea of sinless perfectionism, which is not actually a Christian doctrine, that's a Christian heresy, I guess. With that kind of thing also comes the judgmentalism and lack of grace. So, we're quick to kind of see someone's faults and then just absolutely destroy them for something that we see as abhorrent. And then there is no redemption for that person. Their atonement is to wander in the wilderness, canceled from social media, canceled from whatever their income was, sacked from their job, and no grace.
Mm-mm.
But I think actually Christianity, a doctrine of sin with the accompanying freedom of grace, it says actually you're not going to be sinless in this life. So you can own up to your sin. That's liberating. And you can own up to your sin with full assurance of forgiveness. And when you fail, Dietrich Bonhoeffer says this actually in his book, Life Together. He's got this great little phrase there, the sin of the brother is a cause for my rejoicing. Why is it a cause for your rejoicing? Because you see, here's another sinner, a brother just like me, who lives under and is forgiven by the grace of the Lord Jesus, just like me. It's not that sin is something that you want to celebrate, but that they have sinned is no surprise to you.
Yeah.
But that they are also forgiven is what you're kind of rejoicing in. And I think that's why we want to talk about sin and how we talk about sin and forgiveness, I think, in better ways.
Toby, what is the significance of the doctrine of sin, and what is our understanding of it, and how we talk about and teach it in our ministries matter?
I think there's a few things going on, right? We're mostly familiar with the idea of wanting to do head, heart, and hands application, those kinds of things. And I think that flows out of the greatest commandment stuff that Mike was chatting about earlier of to love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and the second is like to love your neighbor as yourself. But as I reflect on my own sermons to youth and as I think about the sermons that my youth leaders are giving, often they're primarily action-based. And part of that, I think, is a natural thing because actions are controllable and actions or inaction has a tangible relationship impact as well. And so if I sin in action against Kathy, it's much easier for us to work out that our relationship is impaired. Mm. Whereas I think that sinning with your heart and with your mind, almost vertical sin, a bit of a clunky phrase, that's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And yet I think...
Because it's not in front of your face, so it's easy to kind of, I don't know, just not raise it, not think about it.
That's right. That's yep. right. And so I think it's something in that greatest command that implies that Jesus is almost saying you sin in these areas as well.
Mm.
And we'd say yes to that. I think the Sermon on the Mount, no, it's not a Sermon on the Mount, maybe it is.
Somewhere in the Bible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When Jesus calls you, those who hold anger in their, hate their brother in their minds, like they're a murderer, Jesus is raising the bar of sinfulness to not just action, but also our mind and our posture towards each other and our posture towards God himself. And I guess one of the things that I'm really excited for is to think about how does a strengthening in our doctrine of sin transform all our relationships? It's gonna free us up to do good, better, I think, reconciliation, which I'm really looking forward to. But actually, if I can sin against my brother or my sister in my heart, and I need to practice confessing and apologizing and repenting of that sin just as much as when I was a young kid and I punched my sister. Like both of those are sin. And I'm hoping that this conference will help me work out more about how to wrestle and identify the sins of my heart and my mind, because I think they're much more ignorable. And then if I can do that for myself, then I might be in a better position to help my young people that God's trusted me with to work that out as well.
One of the things off the back of what you just said there is that there's a kind of developmental appropriateness to the idea of focusing on sin as action, because, you know, the younger you are, the more concrete the kind of content needs to be in that sense. And so that's a question that I've got is like, well, how do we teach young people, like, and the younger they are, the I guess the more pertinent the question is. Although, I mean, look, I like concrete teaching as well. So, you know, but how do we kind of teach the doctrine of sin in a holistic way, you know, when we're dealing with the developmental realities of the kids in front of us as well? So that's a real, it's an interesting thing to think about. Hey,
I think it's also two sides of the same coin, isn't it? Because we're not, I think J.R. Packer says this, we're not sinners because we sin. We sin because we're sinners.
Mm.
And it's a state. It's not an action. And I always come back to Psalm 51 when I think about this, because the psalmist says, surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me.
Mm.
So even before actions are even possible.
Mm.
The nature is sin. And Paul talks about that in Romans as well. By nature, I am sinful. Mm. So I think I get the concrete reaction to people to say, okay, let's make this easy to understand. Let's think about how we've sinned. But I also think for kids, it's good for them to know it's a state, not an action. And because we are sinners, then as we deal with our sin together, knowing we'll sin against God, we'll sin against one another, that's a necessary part of repentance and growing and maturing in our faith. But there's also, I don't think we can move from the state of being of our sinfulness that then exudes into behavior and our language and our thoughts, of course. But it's bigger than, just what we do, isn't it? You're right, Toby.
Yeah, I think like you see that in Leviticus, right? Like we're doing Leviticus right now. With our kids, I was really challenged by like, hey, actually Leviticus shows us how it's just not just our actions, but actually that like when women get their period, that they're unclean and not able to approach God, or when, you know, you have a rash, like those things are not choices that I've made. I didn't choose to have a rash, and yet I'm not able to approach God in that state. And so yeah, we did it on Sunday. And I remember saying to the kids, like, there's two aspects of us being sinful, right? Like, there's our choices and the times where we choose to, you know, disobey. And that's, you know, where there's a sacrifice required or an offering required. But also there's just the reality of our bodies existing in a broken world that, and I think that was really helpful also for them understanding suffering, which is just such a big thing, is the doctrine of sin provides so many answers and or at least comfort in the suffering aspect, because that's such a big question for them. And then to realize actually some of the world is just affected by sin. And so the fact that, you know, they have family friends who are dying of cancer and they don't understand that, recognizing that Leviticus and so much of the Bible can show us how that's not a direct response to our sin. It's not a punishment. Mm. It's actually just the existence of sin in the world means these things. Like we see it in Job, and, you know, we get that unsatisfying answer where God just says, I'm God. And you can see I'm God. And we see that again in Leviticus, and it's so challenging. But I think those stories really help kids in really practical ways, that you're dealing with concepts, but through really accessible means for them to kind of break it down and see and reconcile what they're seeing in the world around them with what the Bible is saying. They're seeing it. They know something's wrong. Like, I don't know any kid who thinks the world is perfect. I don't know any kid who is under any qualms that something's wrong, something's not right. And so having these, not necessarily full, complete answers that they're like, oh, yeah, cool, I'm fine and I'll never think about this again. But having something that offers, hey, this is an answer to what you're seeing is wrong.
Well, this is why I think it is so important. This is why I wanted us to discuss at a house conference, actually, what you've just raised there, right? You've just spoken about sin as a state of existence, like as in a world which is subject to frustration that is fallen. And so therefore our bodies decay, our societies decay. We are in poor relationship with God in that, you know, I guess sin in that sense is definitely, you want to talk about it in the relational sense. Sin is almost a declaration, like divorce. You know, a husband and a wife may be very amicable to one another and may be very polite and pay their bills. But if they're divorced, they're still divorced, right? Even though they're behaving well and doing whatever, that's a declaration. And you spoke about sin as that kind of state. And so our world is fallen. It is sinful. So that's one way for us to talk about it. But then we also have to talk about sin as in culpability. The things that we have very deliberately decided to do or not to do, which have been sinful actions. And then my suspicion is, and this is what I think I've noticed, is that we often don't make that distinction as we're teaching children and young people, or even as we talk about sin with each other. And when we conflate those two things together, I think that's when we start walking into dangerous kind of zones, right? So someone is born blind, for instance.
Oh, where did you come up with that one from, Mike?
Yeah, I know. I just thought of that one myself. thank you, John 9. Born blind, and you think, who sinned that he was born blind? His parents or him, right? Jesus' answer in John 9 is neither. And then he goes on to heal the man. But of course, his blindness is the result of the state of sin of the world, as in
and
the,
not the state
the
of
new
anyone,
creation.
Not the state of sin of a person, but the state of fallenness of the world.
Fallenness, right? Yeah, but the disciples have made a category error there, right? As they've asked, who's culpable for him, right? So they've got that kind of retribution type of ethic there going on. And I think we do the same as well. So, you know, you've got a kid who's got ADHD or is ASD or something like that, and they've got behavioral issues. And, you know, if you don't quite understand that, you know, you may end up saying this kid is sinful because of their behaviors, when maybe really what you're trying to say is they are suffering the consequences of a sinful world in their fallenness, though they still may be culpable for some of their actions, right? And some maybe not so much. And that's the discussion I think we need to have.
You raise a really complex, like the issue that you raise there shows how messy it can get, because at what point do you point to a kid with ADHD? I'll use that as an example because I live it. At what point do you point to that and say, well, you're culpable of that. You're culpable for that. And at what point do you point to it and go, well, that's just a result of the state of fallenness in which our world exists. And to make a call on that is not an easy thing to do, is it?
Yeah. How much is it an explanation and how much are we using sin as an excuse?
And we can have a tendency to want to point the finger lots, and we can have a tendency to want to not point the finger ever. And gosh, it's a messy thing to try and work out. So,
But as long as we have only a thin understanding of sin, right? You're sinful. This world's sinful. That's sin. That you're sin. But as long as we just keep doing that, we're likely, I think, actually to water down and not do the doctrine of sin justice. And I think we might also end up walking into all kinds of errors. But if you come to a house conference, this is what I think we need to unpack, right? Is thinking about those different categories and therefore thinking very carefully about how we talk about it. So we don't become moralizers. We also don't become permissive. And we don't also just conflate what the Bible has to say about this
important doctrine. I'm in both worlds, right? Like each week I'm doing youth and kids stuff. And I feel like there are some times where I can see that like programs or curriculums or we're in the space where we're ready to kind of separate those two things well. And we're starting to starting to do that with youth. And I'm like, but these kids have lived in this uncertainty when they were kids, and we're underestimating their ability to understand this because they can see stuff is wrong. And I find that really tricky of like, how early am I introducing it in a way that's helpful alongside parents? Because what are parents ready to have conversations of, and how equipped do they feel to have these conversations, particularly when it depends why those questions are coming up, right? Like I've got some questions from kids like this along the lines of sin of, how does, natural disasters and that kind of suffering aspect, and it's fully intellectual question. It's a, hey, something's wrong and I'm able to wrestle with this. And I'm trying to figure out how do we address that in a discussion group when the kid next to them is going through severe mental health issues of their own, is watching their family fall apart before their eyes. And how are we answering and speaking into both places? Because the gospel does speak into both places very clearly in a way that is so comforting. And I've been those kids at different points in my life, but those places are very different answers because, sometimes when Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, he's giving them a hard word and they need to take a seat and listen. And then he's speaking to the woman who's been bleeding for 14 years and gives her comfort and space. And how do we do both? Yeah, like Mel said earlier, how do we do yes and from the front or from alongside when we've got multiple situations in our rooms and groups and all those sorts of things?
And I think we have to use biblical language to do that. And the wisdom comes in where to apply what language the Bible already gives us for sin. We don't need to come up with it on our own. I think there's a reason why the Bible talks about sin in so many different pictures: rebellion, transgression, the flesh. So that's flesh being much more of a state than a behavior. Iniquity, like missing the mark. There are concrete, helpful pictures of sin given to us all through Scripture in different situations. And so I think as leaders and teachers, we have to have great wisdom of where to apply those. And to show kids, actually, there is different versions or nuances or contexts to what we might talk about sin in situation to situation. Yeah, so that we don't leave a kid feeling the weight of, is my experience of sin because of my own brokenness, or vice versa, allowing them to think there's no consequence for their own sin in their life either. So both is failing those kids and youth and us as adults as well, because it's wisdom in applying the picture that the Bible already gives us. I think there's a reason why there's a gamut of them to
draw from,
to use.
All right. Hey guys, what are some of the ways that you've heard sin taught about? What are some of the good and the bad things about that ways of teaching? What do those ways of teaching reveal about what we believe about sin?
One of the metaphors that I've used quite a lot, and I'll be honest, I've used myself, is the clay pot that gets smashed because of sin. And so we're talking about this brokenness of the world. And I think that's a really helpful metaphor to talk about the state of sin, or sin as a state. But it misses the relational aspects of sin as well. And so I think there's great strength in it. It's really visceral. But it misses that sin is also, I think, fundamentally a relational thing between God and us, and us and others.
Yeah, I really like the picture of the impact of sin is that we're not friends with God anymore. We're far from God. That distance and relational language I have found quite helpful. knowing that the work of Jesus and his death on the cross means we can be friends with God. And I think that opens the door for both the comfort and the choice that is to, you know, give your life to Christ, that we can choose to become friends with him again. I think that's a lovely picture. I think it also has its simplicities. And if anything, it's too soft relationally. Biblically, we're enemies with God, not just not friends. We're actually fighting against him when we're in sin and warring against him. But Romans talks about being dead to our sin. We're no longer in Adam. We're now in Jesus. And so, but I think friends is a really concrete, age-appropriate language to talk with kids and youth about. I think the ones I've found most difficult or most problematic are the ones that land us with particular groups of people or particular behaviors. I think any world in which we start, you know, simplifying sin to it looks like this, and so if you do this,
the cultural canonization kind of thing. Can you give us an example of that, Mel?
That's a really good question. I think, particularly as Anglicans, we could fall into the trap of, if you don't come to church every week, or if you come to church but not in your Sunday best, or if you don't know, you know, say the Apostles' Creed or the Lord's Prayer, I think we're at risk in that realm, unless it's part of a broader teaching around, you know, we are saved simply because of the grace of God, not because we walk into church every Sunday morning or attend small group every week. We could read our Bibles every day and still be in the state of sin. So I think that is possibly an example. I think there's heaps more, but I think we could be at risk of packaging sin to look like, well, this group has us bigger sinners than, say, others, or this sin is bigger than, say, another. I think what Mike said earlier is true. There is a hierarchy in types of sin. But we've boiled it down to sexual sin is somehow significantly worse in terms of, is heterosexual sin worse or homosexual sin worse? Or even within the types of sin, we've managed to put ourselves in a position where we are categorizing them. And I think that's helpful.
And we can put them in a category where they seem more irredeemable than others. Yeah. What about you, Kathy?
Yeah, I think, I spend a lot of time, I think, particularly with kids, talking about the broken friendship with God. And so, yeah, that we are now enemies, and that once it was broken, we can't fix it. And that there is, that kind of by very nature opens up the way for like us to then talk about Jesus coming to fix it. And that, when we have wronged someone, the only person that can forgive them is that person, and that Jesus is God and that. But I also think there is a place for talking about fallenness and brokenness, which I've only really come to terms with in the last couple of years, because I think so much of me was like, oh, it minimizes sin and it doesn't talk about our responsibility and the active role that we can play in sin. But I do think it does really speak to a kid's heart or a youth heart of there's something wrong in this world. And that fallen thing showing actually there was and there is a perfection that our heart knows and desires and cries out for, that this is not it. And so this fallenness shows that gap and that distance. And so I think that...
And it produces a longing for you know, final day, right?
Yeah. And so I've just been thinking about, I think on its own it has problems, right? If we just talk about brokenness and fallenness, then we don't think about our responsibility in that, and it takes away some of, I guess, our need for repentance and just go, oh, well, the world's broken, you know, these things happen. And so on its own, I think there are real big problems with talking about sin as fallenness, but that there is a real place for that, particularly like Mike pointed out earlier, that there is kind of two aspects of sin, right? Like our personal sin that we have committed against God, and then also the sin that exists in the world that kind of causes a lot of things. Like, you know, if I lie to someone and our friendship breaks down, that's my sin, and that consequence of sin is a direct response to what I've done. But also my health issues are not a direct response or punishment for what I've done. So I think the brokenness kind of speaks into gives you some space to talk about it, but it doesn't, it can't exist on its own because it's, you know, I mean, as with all analogies, like, you know, no one's got an analogy for the Trinity yet that covers everything. I don't think we've got one for sin either.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us today on the Effective Ministry Podcast. I am really looking forward to this conversation. It's going to be happening in August, 27th, 8th and 9th, Tuesday to Thursday. You can jump on the website, register. Early Bird is still live at the moment if you're listening as this podcast comes out. Hey, guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
No worries.
The Effective Ministry Podcast is a production of Youth Works in Sydney. We want to see effective youth and children's ministry in every church. One of the ways that you can help us do that is by letting people know about this podcast in all the usual ways, like, comment, share, and review on your favorite social media and podcasting platform. If you've got comments, thoughts, or questions for this podcast, you can email us at effectiveministrypodcast@youthworks.net. And also check out youthworks.net for other ways that YouthWorks can help you have effective youth and children's ministry in your church.